from Camp Hill to Erie, Pittsburgh to Danville, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the Supreme Court of the United States has ruled public employees have a constitutional right not to be forced to pay money to labor unions. But unions are flaunting the ruling, and now workers are fighting back. Nathan McGrath of the Fairness Center is here with an update. Are you genetically at risk for cancer? Now there is a way to find out. Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation has Katie Maxwell of Till It's Gone in the Community Benefit Spotlight. And the budget season is getting underway at the nation's capital. The Trump administration is trying to rein in spending. Anna McCausland of Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has a Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Nathan McGrath in just a couple of minutes, but first we have news headlines from patownhall.com. PA Watchdog has put data behind what most Pennsylvanians already know. We pay the highest state gasoline taxes and vehicle fees in the nation. According to the website, we pay 58.7 cents per gallon in state taxes and fees. This does not include the 18.4 cents per gallon in federal taxes. Pennsylvania leads California, New York, Illinois, and other traditionally high tax states in that category. During his single term as governor, Tom Corbett successfully added what amounted to a 30 cent per gallon increase in gasoline fees. Despite bearing the heaviest gasoline tax load in the nation, the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation continues to claim it needs additional revenue. Add that to skyrocketing tolls on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. The Keystone State is one of the most expensive places in the country to drive around. Democratic presidential candidates continue to pop up in Penn's Woods as Bernie Sanders and the less well-known Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan make appearances in the state. Meanwhile, a special election to fill the seat of Republican Congressman Tom Marino, who resigned earlier this year, is heating up. State Representative Fred Keller, the Republican nominee for the sprawling district centered around Williamsport, is the first to go up on television. His ads are basically introductory, focusing on his background and upbringing, although he touts support for President Trump's agenda. Keller will face Democrat nominee Mark Friedenberg in the May 21st special election. A major court battle is brewing over new gun control legislation signed by Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto. Gun rights groups filed lawsuits against the city within minutes of the new laws taking effect. While Peduto welcomed the challenge, he faces an uphill battle. In addition to the Second Amendment protections in the U.S. Constitution, the Pennsylvania state constitution says gun rights shall, quote, not be questioned, end quote. The fact Peduto has violated that clause has led to preliminary efforts to impeach the mayor. A group of citizens also plans to go even further and file a private criminal complaint against the mayor and council. The Allegheny County District Attorney has already weighed in, calling the new laws unconstitutional. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. The constitutional right of public employees not to be forced into paying so-called fair share fees or other levies to labor unions has been reinforced by the U.S. Supreme Court. Yet labor unions are doing everything possible to prevent workers from exercising their rights. Here to talk about several cases now in the courts is Nathan McGrath. Nathan is Vice President and Director of Litigation for the Fairness Center. Nathan, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Nathan, before we talk about specific cases and what is occurring in various municipalities, school districts, counties around the Commonwealth, tell us a little bit about the Janus v. AFSCME ruling. It's something we have talked about on this program a number of times, but just to refresh the memories of our listeners, what was the Janus ruling all about and what rights of public employees did it uphold?
The Janus ruling was decided by the Supreme Court in June of 2018. And just to be short and simple about it, what it said was that unions can no longer compel public employees to pay union fees as a condition of employment, and they have to be non-member employees as opposed to a union member. So union members still can be forced to pay union dues, but if you're not part of the union, then you can no longer be forced to pay fees to the union for representation.
So basically what it did was make union membership voluntary. If you want to join a union, I assume that there's nothing preventing you from doing that, but you can no longer be required to do so or pay so-called fair share. Is that a correct analysis?
Yeah, mostly. So you could never be forced to join a union. That's been settled law for a while. But what you could be forced to do is, even though you didn't join a union, you're still part of what was called a bargaining unit. And so the union still negotiates for you and basically determines your term and conditions of employment. And for that forced representation, the union says, okay, well, we did all this stuff for you, whether you liked it or not, and you have to pay us for it. And so what this ruling did was, no. If these folks don't want to be part of your union, you can't force them to pay you for representation and for spending their money on things that they may or may not want you to do. Now, they can voluntarily do that, but what it used to be was a condition of employment. People could be fired if they did not pay up to the union.
This, of course, a ruling by the highest court in the land. So it affirmed the constitutional right of public employees not to be required to pay any of the items that you just mentioned. So in the aftermath of that, a number of public employees have wanted to exercise their Janus rights or their rights under the Janus decision. The unions, however, have been a little less than cooperative. Tell us some of the efforts that unions have undertaken to frustrate employees from utilizing their rights.
The unions have done any number of things where they've gone around and they've told people to sign particular cards because they need to update their addresses or their phone numbers. And so here, go ahead, sign this card. And what the people are really signing is they're just locking themselves in with some really strong language that we would argue is illegal. But I mean, it can still cause these people problems if they try to get out. Other people have tried to get out and they'll send their letters in and they'll resign, but the unions will just flat out ignore them sometimes. Sometimes they'll say, well, why don't we talk about that? And then they spend years just going around in circles talking, never really knowing if they're out or not, but still having their money deducted. And then other times the union just flat out says, nope, sorry, can't get out.
That would be a very clear violation of the Supreme Court's ruling. So how are unions getting away with this? Getting away with saying, oh, you just can't get out, or saying, oh, you can only get out these 2 weeks out of a 3-year period. It would seem to me that all those things would be a clear violation of constitutional rights. So how are they getting away with this?
We would say, on behalf of many clients we have now who have tried to get out, that that's a violation of their First Amendment, freedom of association, freedom of speech rights. And how the unions here in Pennsylvania are really getting away with it is because in Pennsylvania law, there's what's called a maintenance and membership provision. And it allows an employer, a public employer, and the union to negotiate for basically a 15-day escape window, where during the term of a contract, so you're thinking of contracts here like 3 to 4 years long, well, an employee who wants to leave the union has 15 days at the very end of that time period to make it out. And on top of that, the unions often put it has to be certified mail, has to be hand-delivered. They have all sorts of other obstacles. So even if you hit your 15-day window period, you're still running up against all these other qualifiers. So that's really allowed by PA law, and then it's put into a collective bargaining agreement. And so here in Pennsylvania, that's really what the problem is. And that's what we've challenged in a number of our lawsuits, actually. Our clients have said, hey, my constitutional rights shouldn't be limited to 15 days every 4 years. Like, that's outrageous. And so they've taken their unions to court and we're challenging the statute, the CBA, and the practices of the unions.
We are talking with Nathan McGrath of the Fairness Center. We're talking about how labor unions are frustrating the efforts, and that's probably putting it mildly, throwing roadblocks in the way of public employees who wish to not be a member of a union or have to pay either membership dues or fair share or anything like that, in accordance with what are now their constitutional rights. So let's talk about a couple of specific examples here, Nathan. There is a situation in Cumberland County involving a couple of members, and this is in the Cumberland Valley School District. Tell us a bit about this particular case.
This case is, our client is a man named Curtis Thompson, and he's an education aide in the Cumberland Valley School District and loves his school district, loves the kids he works with, and he just doesn't really love his union. And he doesn't have any malicious intent towards them, but he just doesn't feel like they're representing him very well. And so he actually tried to leave the union back in May of 2017, and he sent a letter in, and he was told, no, you can't get out. And over the course of a year, we're coming up on 2 years now, he sent four different letters, some of which have been ignored, some have been responded to, and he's gotten responses everywhere from, well, look in your CBA, and that tells you how to get out, to, hey, you can't get out except for the 15-day window period. So he's been struggling for a while to try to find an answer, how to get out. And then he came upon us, and we agreed to represent him. And we've just recently filed a lawsuit for him. And basically what I was saying earlier, we've alleged on his behalf that, number one, the Pennsylvania statute that allows for this 15-day period is unconstitutional and violates his First Amendment rights. The CBA provision, same thing. And the union's practices and procedures all are unconstitutional and violate his rights. And he should have the right to associate and to get in the union, just like he should have his rights to disassociate and get out of the union.
And in his particular case, it's not so much a matter that he doesn't want to belong to a union. He just feels that the union he's in, which represents, according to your release, janitorial workers, cafeteria, technical staff, and he is a counselor working with at-risk students, he just doesn't feel that particular union is a good match for what he does.
That's absolutely correct. He's actually a union guy. He likes unions. He thinks that they can do a lot of positive things. But if you talk with him a while about it, he'll say, you know, I'm really an educator. I'm in the classroom talking with kids who are having problems. I'm helping them to do better in their classwork and in life generally, those types of things. And he said, the union that I'm matched with, basically, I don't think they have the resources or the ability to represent my needs and what I'm looking for. And I think he probably would be open to another union that he does feel is competent. But again, it goes back to this choice thing, right? You should have the choice whether to belong to a union or to join a different union or to represent himself, really.
Well, you might have a constitutional right, but at times you have to fight in order to exercise it. We have been talking with Nathan McGrath, who is Vice President and Director of Litigation at the Fairness Center. Nathan, tell us just a little bit about the Fairness Center and where folks can go if they want to get in touch with you.
The Fairness Center is a nonprofit public interest law firm, and we get to represent those who have been injured by public sector union officials. We've represented organizations who have members who have been injured. We obviously represent individual employees, like we've been talking about. And we actually even represent a local union that was injured by a bigger union. And so we get to meet great people and help them exercise their rights. You can find us at thefairnesscenter.org or call 844-293-1001.
Nathan McGrath of the Fairness Center. Nathan, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Knowing that you may be at risk for certain genetically passed cancers can help with early detection of the disease. Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation has Katie Maxwell of Till It's Gone in this week's Community Benefit Spotlight.
Thank you, Loman, and thank you, Katie, for being a guest on the Lincoln Radio program.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Katie, you're working on some very interesting work. It has to do with healthcare, and it's a very fascinating story, but very close to you because you're actually experiencing it. Tell the listeners, if you would, we're working with cancer here. What kind of cancer are you working with and combating?
I have a genetic cancer, and that inspired me to start the nonprofit Till It's Gone. And we are hoping to prevent late-stage diagnosis of genetic cancers.
When you say genetic cancers, these are cancers that are passed down through the father and or mother, and you have one in particular. Are there a lot of the genetic cancers?
There are. We actually test for ovarian, breast, colon, pancreatic, and prostate and uterine cancers. And I believe this is just the tip of the iceberg. I think once there's more research, we will start to find even more genetic links. When we started this testing, we tested for 21 mutations, and now we're already up to 30 mutations.
That's amazing. So it seems like if somebody lives long enough, they're going to get cancer. Is that a sound statement?
It is definitely a possibility, because all it takes is for one cell to make a mistake and then repeat itself. So people are more at risk, I think, than they realize for this disease.
And you're working with primarily your interest is in female genetic cancers, but this interview is very important for both men and women. Talk about the importance of that.
It is. There are men and women across the country who unknowingly carry mutations that put them at a greater risk for cancer. And not only is it a risk for themselves, but it's also a risk for their children and their families. And men are carriers, and also they get genetic cancer. My father actually passed my mutations on down to me. I'm BRCA1 and 2 positive, and I had no family history of cancer because he had just been a carrier. But men can get genetic cancers such as prostate, colon, and pancreatic cancers, as well as women getting breast and ovarian, primary peritoneal, and uterine cancers.
Where are we in the research stage of dealing with these cancers? What stage of cancer might somebody be in where it's still pretty treatable or curable? And at what point does it go where it's more serious than that?
Early detection is extremely important, and that's why we use this genetic screening as a tool, because it helps people know if they need early cancer screening or prophylactic surgeries. Because when cancer is caught in stage 1 and 2, it is treatable and often curable. And I'm not sure people realize that. The reason cancer is so devastating is because it's more commonly caught in stage 3 and 4. And at that point, it becomes very difficult to treat.
You started with your cancer long before it got diagnosed. You didn't have this test taken. For one thing, it probably wasn't even available at the time. How long was it before you realized that you had cancer?
I had symptoms for 2 years, and they were misdiagnosed because often cancer symptoms can mimic other things. I live pretty high-stress life. I travel a lot, and there were concerns that maybe it was my lifestyle that was causing the symptoms and the fatigue. I was in stage 4 before I was diagnosed, and I did not even receive genetic testing until after my first line of treatment. I was not in remission. And I decided I need to investigate a little further and requested genetic screening and found out that I have BRCA1 and 2 positive mutations.
For those who don't know what that is, what is BRCA1 and 2?
They are the mutations that are associated with a dramatic increased risk for ovarian cancer, peritoneal cancer, breast cancer, and pancreatic and prostate cancer.
So you had access, actually, to some pretty good health care and even wanted to elect to have surgeries that would have addressed the cancer before you even knew you had it. What was your experience with that?
If I had known that I had the mutations, I would have absolutely had prophylactic surgery. And especially in my case, I was finished having my children, and I would have been screened earlier for the cancer so that it could have been caught in stage 1 or 2. I know many people who have the same cancer I have who were caught in stage 1 and have been cured. So it's the early detection that is so important. And with this test, what it does is that it gives people access to early screening, because the insurance companies will pay for early screening if they have a positive mutation and prophylactic surgeries, because it's easier for them and less expensive for them to prevent a late stage diagnosis than it is to pay for the treatment. The other important thing is that genetic information cannot be used as a pre-existing condition. So there should be no fear in getting this information, especially with the uncertainty of our healthcare right now, and thinking that an insurance company can use it against you. There's a law that states they cannot.
This is Joe Geiger on the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today is Katie Maxwell. Katie is a nurse and actually a horseman, which if you go to her site, you may find her in either category. The test itself is not that onerous. Talk a little bit about what that procedure looks like and what happens with the data.
We are partners with Kalos Genetics, and they are offering a genetic screening through us at half price. So it's normally $250, but if you screen through us, it's $125. And if you press on the link on our webpage and our Facebook page, then you will be directed towards the registration. Once you register, you will receive a test in the mail, and it's simply a cheek swab. It's non-invasive. It's not difficult to do. You just swab your cheek, put the swab back in the container, and you'll have all of the equipment to mail the test back to Kalos. And with registration, you will also receive genetic counseling at no extra cost. And the genetic counselors are available if you're having anxiety waiting on your results, or if you test positive and you need guidance. And if you do test positive, Kalos also acts as a liaison to your physician to ensure that you have access to follow-up care.
Prevention is always less expensive than treatment of things, but we tend not to want to invest in the prevention because at that stage, I guess there's a fair amount of denial that it could be me that's passing a gene on or me that maybe actually has the illness?
Correct. And, you know, we like to look at it as when people go in for their preventative health care physicals, they get a cholesterol level taken. And if they treat their cholesterol, they decrease their risk for heart disease. And this is the exact type of concept that we have with genetic testing. If you know you're at risk, then you take steps to decrease your risk of developing the disease. But you also have the information for family planning or if you already have children to help protect your children also. Because if a parent tests positive, then it's important that when the children come of age and you can test at 19 years or older, that they also be tested.
This is Joe Geiger on the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today is Katie Maxwell. Katie's starting an organization named Teal It's Gone. And Katie, if somebody is interested in finding out more about your program, how can they find you?
You can reach us through our Facebook page if you want to contact us, or you can go to our website, and it's tealitsgone.org. That's one word and no apostrophe. So it's T-E-A-L-I-T-S, gone, G-O-N-E, dot org. And our contact information is on the website, along with a link is on the Facebook page and the website to the test registration.
Katie, thanks for being a guest on the Lincoln Radio Program today. Back to you, Yoloman.
Congress hasn't passed a federal budget in decades. Despite that, the annual budget process is now underway for the fiscal year beginning October 1st. Anna McCausland of Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Last month, the White House released the president's budget for fiscal year 2020. This budget sets a vision for spending, taxes, and debt for the coming year and the next decade. It features a broad mix of spending priorities and proposes a net reduction in total government spending of $2.7 trillion over 10 years from a mix of discretionary and mandatory spending reductions. That's a good step in the right direction, but we need to do more to address our nation's escalating spending and debt crisis. Members of Congress from both sides of the aisle should work together with the president to tackle out-of-control spending, tame the debt, and secure America's economic future. Here's a breakdown of what you need to know about the proposal. In 2011, Congress passed the Budget Control Act, the BCA, a modestly successful attempt to curb discretionary spending. However, time and time again, lawmakers have bursted through the caps of the series of disappointing budget deals. The Trump administration's budget prioritizes returning to the caps set by the BCA. The proposal also focuses on reducing spending projections over the next decade by, among other steps, reducing total discretionary spending by a net $577 billion, or 4% over 10 years, reducing mandatory spending by a net $1.7 trillion, which is a 5% reduction, Making other mandatory spending reforms like student loans, agriculture, welfare, and unemployment, pairing those budget reductions with programmatic reforms that together will help put Americans on a path to a self-sufficiency instead of dependency. It also addresses waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicare and Medicaid, leverages the resources and expertise of the private sector by privatizing federal power agencies. Washington routinely uses accounting gimmicks to hide spending, though, and unfortunately, this budget is not all that different. The administration wants to return to the BCA caps for discretionary spending, which is a laudable goal. It also wants to boost defense spending. The proposed budget accomplishes this by providing operational spending increases for the Overseas Contingency Operations, OCOs, which is intended to fund the war on terror. The White House would increase OCO and emergency defense funding, also not subject to the BCA caps, by $174 billion from fiscal year 2019 levels, bringing total defense-related spending to $750 billion in 2020. This budget, like many before it, assumes higher economic growth and revenues than the baseline. This doesn't have any policy impact, but it does make it easier to reduce debts and deficits than it would otherwise be. Another issue is that the proposal does not address the structural deficiencies in mandatory spending programs such as Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. These programs are the real drivers of our spending problems. And while addressing waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicare and Medicaid are good steps, we need more far-reaching solutions to make these programs sustainable and affordable for seniors who truly rely on these programs today and the taxpayers of tomorrow. The White House is putting forth a handful of new proposals amounting to billions in new spending. Creating new entitlement programs before addressing our current spending programs only makes them worse. Without greater action, the fiscal health of the United States will continue to deteriorate. Annual federal spending is expected to hit $7 trillion in just 10 years. The national debt will also skyrocket, hitting $31 trillion in that same amount of time. That will leave America with fewer jobs, lower wage growth, and make it harder to start and expand a business. It will also hinder our ability to handle severe economic shocks or potential pressing budget priorities we can't foresee, such as wars or other financial crises. Americans for Prosperity is encouraged to see the administration make a good faith effort to rein in spending. Addressing America's debt problem will be a long-term challenge, and to meet it, we need more substantive changes to tackle out-of-control spending and mounting debt. Both parties must come together to solve our spending problem. Go to AmericansForProsperity.org. I'm Anna McCausland, Deputy State Director with Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania. Follow us on Twitter at AFP Pennsylvania and give us a like on Facebook. Search for Americans for Prosperity PA.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 24 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WVMM-FM in Grantham, along with WEXC-FM and WGRP-AM in Greenville, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Worrell Foundation of Carlisle, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.
Thank you.